So welcome to the Equitopia podcast from the horse's mouth. I'm Caroline Higgerty, founder of Equitopia, and today I'm really excited to be speaking with Shauna Kerrish, who is a somewhat of a household name for many equestrians around the world. Her work in the field of behaviour has had a big influence on how we go about applying positive reinforcement when working with our equine partners. So Shauna, welcome to the podcast and thanks for taking part.
Oh gosh, it's a pleasure to be here.
Great. So I'd like to start by asking you how you first got interested in horses and how that interest took you to working professionally with horses.
Okay, well, gosh, that's an interesting story, because I was working with marine mammals. So I had 10 years of training marine mammals, which is 100% positive reinforcement. There's no pressure, release, halters, lead ropes, bits, you know, none of that. So what I had done is after I'd been there probably like nine years, Elizabeth Bush Burke of Anheuser-Busch gave some of us trainers at the park tickets to go see a show jumping Grand Prix in Del Mar. And so we went to go see it, and I now had a new reference for horses, you know, with the positive reinforcement history. And so I saw some of the horses jumping that night. That more often than not, they didn't look happy, I'll have to say. You could see horses that were doing it, and it was a stressful event. But there are two that night that looked like a walk in the park. Like, this was easy, and this was joyous, and this was fun. And that triggered in me, I want to do this. And I wanted to ride Grand Prix. Of course, I didn't know what, you know, I didn't know what that entailed, but I just loved that idea. So I started looking into it, and I had access to Grand Prix show jumpers, and they kept saying, no, horses don't learn like this. You can't do this. This is not how it's done. And those weren't really solid answers for me, because I had seen with my own eyes, target train hyenas, meerkats, hippos, rhinos, lions, tigers, giraffes, bears, goldfish, sharks. So I thought, I don't understand why horses wouldn't get this. But who's to say I haven't done it? So I kind of kept sitting on the periphery. And then I read a magazine article, kind of a cheesy magazine, it was People magazine, about a man named Tom Dorrance. And I thought, this guy sounds different. So I had the cheekiness to call him on the phone.
Awesome.
So I just called him and I said, hey, I'm a marine mammal trainer and I'd like to take this training principles, you know, which is science-based training, to horses. And he was very encouraging. And he said, yes, I definitely think it would work. You should do it. Turns out he had recognized that food was really powerful for situations, but he didn't know how to systematically do it. Like, you know, what we do with marine mammals is a systematic way of applying it and fading it and you know, creating the game, you know. So it is, but he recognized that food does something, but I don't know how to make it stronger. And he even invited me to come to his ranch and put it into effect with him. And I was like, I have to work. You know, I didn't recognize kind of how high of a profile he is in his particular world and how much experience. But it was with that conversation from him that I really went into horses. And so I started and I looked and I started taking lessons on that phone call. I thought, I'm going to start taking lessons in to figure out how it was done traditionally. I didn't feel like it was fair to think I'm going to come in and change something if I didn't really know what was going on.
Yep.
So I did that. And then I came across, my ex-husband was a Grand Prix show jumper that rode with George Morris for 5 years and was a very soft rider. And he was friends with John and BZ Madden because he had ridden with them. And so we go to dinner with John Madden, and Vinton says, tell John about the training you did with the marine mammals. So I just started talking about the science and the principles and how it worked and put it into effect. And John Madden was like a sponge. He was like, he just soaked it all in. And I had sent him home with a clicker, an old clicker I'd had from SeaWorld. But the clicker had been, we never used it with the marine mammals really much because we didn't call it clicker training. That's a dog term. But so I gave him an old clicker and he went home, and BZ had a horse who was terrified of the riding stick and it came to her that way. So you couldn't have it on the ground. Your partner couldn't have it. You couldn't have it on his back. You couldn't. And he called and said, not only did I get, this is the first day, not only did I get this horse to touch the riding stick, I can't get him to stop. You know, so he said, if I could turn this big of a no into this big of a yes, this quickly, there's a place for this in Grand Prix show jumping. So I went and I moved and he said, come here, I'll pay you. We'll start a business. We'll do this. This is what, you know, this is exciting. And so that's where I started. And I went to John and Beezy's and ended up living and traveling and working with horses of all different levels, and it was amazing. So that's where I really started. And there, from there, I realized after a while, but this is for everybody, not just Grand Prix show jumpers. But so I got a chance to work with Olympic level, international levels in all different sports. And then I've worked with backyard and feral and, you know, everything else in between.
Do you find that there's an objection to the food, or how do you find that in general the horse industry responds to the idea of using food in a training scenario? Because I've heard a lot of people like, oh, that creates monsters, and oh, you should never do that, and we should expect horses to just do what we want them to do all the time. Do you find that that's an objection, and if so, how do you go about trying to overcome it or explain to people the role and the pros and cons and the criteria by which you use food?
Yeah, and I think that is a great question, because it is a big concern for people. I mean, that is probably the biggest objection you really get. And so what I realize when people say that, one, they either don't understand how to use it well, or they've seen it not done well. Because this training, like any other training, can be done badly. You know what I mean? You can cause troubles, and you can create those situations like you're talking about. But if you're doing it correctly, it is the most important, the most valuable reinforcer we actually have in the training situation, because it is something they need to survive. So you have to be ethical about that, because you don't ever want to, you always want to have a horse to have all the food they want, but part of the game starts changing how they look at it. So there's always a reinforcer involved. So a reinforcer simply increases the frequency of behavior. So they're either getting something they want or avoiding something they don't want. The end. So it's science, you know, and I tell people, I didn't make this up. So I go back to science a lot. But if you think about it, even the mildest form of aversive is still something they're avoiding, you know? So as much as we go, I just barely did anything, but that's been, they're still trying to avoid something or get something they want. So, and typically the getting something they want is related more to survival. And, you know, they want food, air, sleep, sex, you know, water, those kind of things are really, really strong. And frankly, they're born with a desire for those things. So that makes they're very powerful, you know, more powerful than anything. So it's all in the approach, and how do you train it and condition it? So I try to really help them understand that by utilizing something they want, because we're grabbing something, we're either getting something they don't want or something they want. So if instead of, you know, using spurs or a whip or a harsher bit, or you could do it without any bit, you know, but with why not grab a few cookies, with the difference it makes in the horse's attitude? Because it really does change. It changes things. The biggest change really happens on the inside. It is deep down inside, and it'll change many more things. In the very beginning, I saw people really look at it as a means to an end. You know, I want to improve my canter depart. I want to improve trailer loading. I want to improve jumping, you know, and that was really where they saw that. But you know what? The biggest, and that's certainly a way we could do it, but the changes that start happening actually start on a much, much deeper level. Internally, they start having, you know, dopamines and endorphins and feeling good about life. In that very first week when I worked with John and Beezy, at the end of the first week, and Beezy Madden is a very quiet person, she said, each of those horses you're working is remarkably better in the arena. But keep in mind, all I did was condition the clicker in their stall for 3 5-minute sessions a day for 3 days. Then the next 3 days was 3 5-minute sessions a day of the target training. It had nothing to do with their ridden work. Beezy wasn't a part of these sessions, and I wasn't a part of her ridden sessions. We all watched each other, but yet these horses were remarkably better in the arena. And that was the beginning of me going, that's really interesting, and something more is going on. So it's trying to get people to understand that. And the hard part is, frankly, they have to kind of experience a little bit to really grasp it. So it takes a leap of faith. And I think most people that come to me that don't know, they come desperate. And they say, I'll do whatever crazy thing you have to do. And that's where they go, you know. So it is a challenge, and I don't think there's one exact answer, but I do fall back to the science quite a bit.
So that would lead me to another question. So would you find that people don't give consideration to the emotional side of a horse's life and how that might impact their performance?
Yes, I find that quite a bit. And I think that's been a part of our, it's part of our culture, many cultures, not just American, you know, it's European, it's, you know, in the Latin countries. I think it has been a part of our culture that these guys are kind of have been beasts of burden. They've been, you know, and I think And of course, you cannot say that as a flat policy, because some people really do consider that. But still, I think we can put our own agendas too far ahead of the horse's well-being. When I was a little girl, I was abused as a kid. And so from a really young age. And at six, I had made this determination. I didn't want to be a part of the horses because I could recognize they were good once you caught them, but we were imposing ourselves on them. And that was something I recognized. I didn't know then, but as an adult, I knew this was learned helplessness. And I see these horses all the time now. And people are like, oh, he's great. He loves it. He does everything. He's perfect under saddle. But you watch the other things and you realize this isn't actually the straight story. And people don't recognize it. They have good intentions. And then when I was 7 years old, I made a decision. I didn't want to be a part of any person or animal's life that I didn't help to improve their quality of life. Now, people I figured out are very complicated, and they have a choice. They can come or go. So I took those off the table. But the animals didn't choose this. We chose this for them, all of them. And so I think it's really important that we are here to be good stewards for them. So I feel like I'm here to serve the horse. And I don't care if that horse is ridden or not ridden. If we can help that horse, you know, that being, that sentient being, needs somebody to be a voice for them. So I do think that by and large, we've kind of lost track of that. And I think we can kind of, you know, you hear people saying, he's a jerk, he's being stubborn. Well, those aren't really labels that are appropriate. These horses weren't born mean. There was nothing in there that started out with some malicious intent. This is learned behavior that we humans have created in them. And I think that one of the big keys to getting people to accept a different way of training is going to be to create more empathy and more compassion and really putting themselves in the horse's shoes.
That sounds fantastic, Shauna. So the next question for you is there anything you feel that you've learned or discovered just recently, maybe in the past 5 years, that you think, gosh, I wish I had known that when I was starting out in my life as an equestrian?
I think, you know, I never stop learning. So I learn and grow and learn and grow and learn and grow and become more aware. I think my first issue that I really didn't recognize fully was how little people do recognize emotions or look at emotions. To me, that was a natural. The marine mammals wouldn't do their job if they didn't think it was fun. So you had to be very aware of how emotionally they were feeling, that they showed up and said they got all their food regardless of what they did or didn't do. So it was our job to make it fun. To me, that was so natural that I didn't think I had to say that. You know what I mean? And I recognize that that hasn't really been a thing. So I think that was probably my biggest learning curve that I had to do. And it took me a few years. So I really kept thinking, people aren't, you know, they're not taking this into account. So I think that has been pretty significant. I think, you know, even what we learned, you know, this weekend with Garrett, I think the considering the physical side of riding. We can make riding be something they love and they totally enjoy, but there's a lot to that that we tend to overlook. And I think that is there pain? Is there discomfort? Does the saddle fit? Do they have a bad history and now they're bringing it with them? What, you know, what are they sore? Am I unbalanced? And I think all the, and how do you help a horse to use himself most correctly, naturally? You know what I mean? So yeah. Not every horse uses their self the best they could naturally, but how can we easily kind of help them find that balance? And so I think that part has been probably my most recent bigger awareness in the past 5 years, is just how much that is something that you really, people need to learn about too. Because again, it's a thing, you take it for granted that we need to do this, but there's people that have no clue about what balance is or moving correctly is. Or so I think that's probably been a pretty big influence.
Great. So if you could only tell horse owners or riders one thing that you were guaranteed they would listen to and take action on, is there any particular thing that you would say would be a key eye-opening moment that you've experienced with clients who've come across you for the first time?
Yes, I think my biggest number one thing is to simplify things. Everything our horses do outside of reflexive behavior like startle, those things, everything is basically a choice that they make. And they're going to choose a thing with the strongest reinforcement history. So either avoiding something they don't like or getting something they like. So as I look at a behavior and I think, well, clearly what, you know, a horse who won't get in the trailer, let's say, it means he finds it more reinforcing to avoid the trailer than to get in the trailer. So there's not some big malicious intent. I don't care. It just, he's doing what has worked for him. So it's easy for me to then go, okay, we need to rebalance these scales and pile reinforcement on the other side of the scales until their new choice is, I love the trailer. The trailer's awesome. So I think that's really important, but also to break that down. And if I don't care if a horse is trying to kill me, and I've dealt with horses that truly want to kill humans, and you don't go in with them right away, but you can work through that. But I look at that. Is it dangerous to me? Absolutely. Could I die? Absolutely. But they're not mean. There's not a mean that he's doing what has worked for him. And for whatever reason, they have found that keeping people away is more important than, or more valuable to them than finding people to be desirable or liking to be around them. So not, I don't take it personally. I just really look at it and think, this behavior's worked for him, and I would like a different behavior to work for him, and I'm going to change it in a systematic way. But in the process, what we change is the emotions. So I think if we can simplify, if a horse is doing something we don't like, there's a reason, you know. So let's break it down and try and rechange that or replace it with a new, better behavior.
Sounds great. So just to put something in perspective, say, for example, and we're looking at the role of behavior in, say, a complex situation with a horse, say an owner comes and the horse has been pinning his ears and kicking out when the saddle comes. They've done the work and realized that that was the problem. They've now got a proper fitting saddle, but they're still the horse is still pinning the ears when the saddle comes out. Can you explain a little bit about what is happening from the behavioral aspect and how a plan would go into effect for, say, that example of something like that, where you've solved the problem, but the behavior is still there?
Yeah, I think that's a great question, because actually I see it more than people recognize. You know, horse who won't take the bit, won't take the bridle, won't go the cross ties, doesn't like to sit. All those things, goat that hates the mounting block. So usually it is a predictor of something that has been uncomfortable, painful, unpleasant, scary, intimidating, you know, whatever maybe has happened, but there's an element that predicts what can come next. So in the case of a saddle fit, a bad saddle fit, they think, this causes pain. I don't want to do this. So now we fix it. We've got a great saddle. We've invested. We've done all the time. We've made sure that their back is now not sore and knotted anymore. And we've got all those pieces sorted. But the horse doesn't know that, you know, really what caused it. He just thinks, person in the saddle, saddle on my back, pain, you know, so he doesn't know it's gone. So I think it's a reinforcement history. You know, he's learned, this is bad. I would like to avoid this at every cost. So they're doing what they can to communicate. And I think that that is really important. And with that, I'm also going to point out really recognizing, and I think this is a huge help if people can get this minute, recognizing when you put the saddle on, does your horse's nostrils flare? Or does the chin get pointy? Or does the lip get square? Or does the head raise? Or does their tension in their neck? Or does their tail swish? You know, all of those things are actually really loud and clear communications that if we can get that, instead of it turning to bite us, you know, we can get it early and go, what's up with that? Why is this discomfort? Or why is this causing you to show signs of tension? Now, it might be that it was another horse next to him, but I pay attention to those things and start to see a pattern. But I think what they have is they're trying to communicate all along what their troubles are. So recognizing that there's a strong reinforcement history with the pain. There's an association. They think this is bad. This is not good. I would basically go back like it's a baby and say, can I put the saddle pad on? Click, reinforce, and build a new, better association with every single little part. So they're like, I love the saddle pad. Now the saddle pad makes me feel good. And then you build it up until you can create a new association and new emotions replace those old unhappy ones.
That sounds great. So as you know, with Equitopia, we just look at the whole horse, whole rider situation. We look at the role of each professional in the team approach to making sure that all these things that we've kind of touched on during our conversation are addressed. So as part of our podcast series, we're asking each individual person on how they see the role of the other team members. And so I want to ask you just a little bit about that. Say, if you are putting a team together, what in your view makes an ideal trainer as a partner for your side of things?
Okay. I think that because sometimes you go out there and people will say really good things and then you watch their work and you're like, well, that doesn't line up somehow, or they just get stuck at what's being said. So I think one of the things I really want to do, I want to look, does that horse look genuinely happy to me? Not just obedient, But does that horse look generally happy in everything they do? Do the other horses in the barn who are with that trainer look happy in everything they do? Or if I have a video, turn the sound off. Don't listen to the words. Listen to the horse. Look for those, you know, does this look happy? Does this look clear? If you don't know what the trainer's even asking, there's a lack of clarity, you know? So it should be clear. Clarity creates relaxation. That's really important. So I think kind of putting out, listening to what's said is one part, but looking at the results is the bigger part. So a lot of people say a lot of wonderful things, and then it, when you watch it, it doesn't always come down to it. So I think really looking at the other horses, are the horses really happy? I think that's really important. So getting a bead on that, because it's hard to tell sometimes, you know, with if you just listen to what they say.
And what would you say you would be looking for if you were looking at an equine veterinarian?
Equine veterinarian, I feel like I really think this is, again, a holistic approach. I really enjoy the farrier or the veterinarian who will go Eastern or Western. You know what I mean? They're not afraid to go, you know what, let's try this deep massage for this. Or no, now we need antibiotics. You know, so I want a vet like my doctor that is going to be open to both sides and using alternative things and not always rushing in with some harsh chemicals or big major treatment. But really, I want them to be open to that side. So that's really important to me.
And on the role of nutrition, we cover a lot on nutrition. Do you have a wish list for nutrition?
Well, I think that one can be a little trickier because I don't know as much about, you know, I rely on my vets and my people around me. So I think that one might be a little bit of having to hear them out. And there can be a lot of different philosophies. And so I think you need to kind of think, does this philosophy agree with what I think? You know, and what does this make sense? Would I do this? You know, would I eat this kind of diet? You know, not literally, but, you know, the balance between starches and sugars or whatever it could be. And it, that kind of needs to appeal to you, I think, a little bit on your own. But I think beyond that, try it and see, you know, really monitor. Does the horse look better? Does he not seem better? Does, you know, so I think that one's a little trickier for me to give advice on.
Okay. Saddle fitting?
And, you know, and I would definitely, and in both of these situations, I would go to people I respect and get their opinion too. So I want people that have done the work and can help me kind of whittle it down. So like with Ecotopia, you know, you want to go to someplace where you say, okay, there's a million, what do I do? So I think the saddle fitters is the same thing. You know, they should be responsive and listening and adjusting to everything you say. If you say, I don't feel like this is right for him, I want them to listen to that. I think sometimes they can poo-poo things and say, you don't know what you're talking about. They don't say that literally. But yeah. So I think word of mouth, thinking about what type of saddle you have. And again, really watching the horses, you know.
Back to the horses.
Yeah.
Well, that's fantastic. I've really enjoyed chatting with you, Shauna. And I suppose just to finish up, do you have any particular hopes and desires for the future of the equestrian world from your perspective?
Yeah. I mean, I definitely hope to see a kinder, gentler, more thoughtful, more awareness, you know, moving forward with horses. I would like to see people not just thinking what they want to get done, but, you know, how is the horse really happy? Utilizing positive reinforcement is a great environmental enrichment. It actually fulfills their lives quite a bit. But I think riding can be too, if we've done it right and we've built it up. I think just working on our relationships more than our goals. And I'm at Terra Nova in Santa Fe, New Mexico. And Terra Nova, what we're aspiring to do is taking the positive reinforcement training to the show world. So bridging that gap between the show people who, you know, can get caught up in the show sense. But how do we create positive, solely positive reinforcement techniques to address problems that have been there forever? How can I create balance without necessarily first needing to get on and adjust it with equipment? How can I get the horse to create that balance or that bend or that sidestep or that, you know, whatever it is? So it's a very exciting time. And I think reaching that group and helping them to be more aware and more slow down and let the horse do it, I think that's my big hope. That's a big invested dream for me right now.
yeah, that's a part of Equitopia's competition, and horse welfare shouldn't be mutually exclusive. So right. We look forward to your contribution to that. So again, thank you very much. So for those of you listening, stay tuned. We'll be doing more with Shauna later on, and we hope you enjoy this very intimate 20 or 25 minutes with Shauna, and we will catch you later.
Thank you.